You notice Eric wears a coat while he plays the drums, but his shirt hangs out. And it's not ironed. The reason he wears the coat is to hide the fact that the shirt is not ironed and probably dirty. That's his mother's fault. I mean, that's not. No. Yeah, well, like I said, I'm a little tired this morning. I can still run fast, and we'll just make it. Anyway, January 18th, here we go. Lecture discussion number 76 on Genesis 1 through 19. Last Sunday, the discussion was mostly about dirt. The two mule loads of dirt that Naaman, the Syrian commander that had leprosy, requested from Elisha the prophet after he was healed. And Elisha refused payment, 2 Kings 5:16, I will receive nothing. That is a highlighted verse, or should be a highlighted, memorized verse. That's the key to that entire passage of Scripture, 2 Kings 5, I will receive nothing. As soon as he says, I will receive nothing, then Naaman the Syrian, he wants two mule loads of dirt. And so we went over that last week, trying to figure out why two mule loads of dirt. And, of course, we solved it, didn't we? So we're moving on. Maybe we didn't completely solve it, but enough. Anyway, the I will receive nothing, highlight that, know where it is. That is the verse that teaches the principal doctrine of 2 Kings 5, that salvation is a gift of mercy from God. He will receive nothing for salvation. He will receive nothing because there is nothing we can give him that can reach the standard that would be required of it. He is cleansing us from our filth, our decaying, our hopeless condition, and that is free. It is grace. And when you begin to consider why it must be free, that becomes very important to you. Understanding why he must say, Elisha must say, I will receive nothing, becomes very, very important to you. That's wisdom. Understanding salvation by grace. God's omniscience, you hear me say this all the time, requires that this is the only possible way that salvation could be accomplished. It must be given freely. If you say there are other alternatives, other ways of salvation, then you are challenging the omniscience of God. There is only one possible way. That's required by the very word and the essence of omniscience. If there were another way, then his omniscience would demand something, wouldn't it? What would it demand? That one of the ways be eliminated. Because one way would always be better than any other. There aren't any co-equal ways. That's math. Think it through. His infinity requires that salvation be given. So his omniscience requires it, and his infinity requires it, because infinity cannot be purchased by the finite. We are the finite. He is the infinite. When he gives his grace, when he gives his salvation, when you understand what his salvation entails, you realize the cost of it cannot be accomplished by the finite. And therefore, salvation by grace alone is the great proof that Christ is God in the flesh. I jumped a few steps, but it is geometry. You have to solve something. You have to prove something, right? You have given. Salvation by grace alone is the great proof that Christ is God in the flesh. All you have to do is ask simple questions. What exactly is salvation? How does it work? What is the spiritual process of it? What is the physical process of it? Why is it necessary? As soon as you begin to wrestle with those, you discover that Christ is God. Jesus Christ ends up being the only source of life, blood. Blood that is life, flesh that is life. And then you decide very quickly that only God himself is life, and therefore Jesus Christ is God. Only God can cleanse sins. Only God can forgive sin. What is the process then of forgiveness? I'm spitting these out quickly. We have people mumbling in the back. Do we need the police? Yes, we do. You go and just beat them senseless. There's a shovel on your way. Who would want Rebecca after them? No one. No one. Besides Bill.
Well said. Yeah. Thank you, Rebecca. Is my family again, wasn't it? Yeah. Once again, who's responsible? You have to consider that. Okay. What is the process? What does God go through? The peanut gallery attacks. What is the process of forgiveness? What does God do exactly? What is he going through exactly to forgive? How is that accomplished? He's omniscient. What would you say he does to forgive? Does he forget? He's omniscient. You must reconcile forgetting with omniscience. How does he erase something? What does he do? And we get clues through Scripture of his process, and we see it first and foremost in the Ark of the Covenant, or the Ark of the Testimony, the mercy seat, the blood that's on the mercy seat, the encapsulation and all of that that's going on. Anyway, the process of forgiveness is very important. Naaman's healing from leprosy portrays these kinds of truth and many others, and it's a very important chapter, 2 Kings 5, and you need to know it. And if you teach one Old Testament passage to your children, my kids will tell you that when I had them alone in bed, I'd read them stories about lions eating children. That's the truth. I did. Where are they? They're not here. Yes, they are. Didn't I? Yes. And you loved them, didn't you? Yes, he did. But I did. I read them stories about man-eating lions. I had reasons for it. It falls into that weird thing again. But point being is that if you teach one Old Testament passage to your children, in my opinion, it should be the leprosy of Naaman the Syrian. It's very, very important to them to understand the doctrine that is there. Forgiveness is there. Cleansing of sin is there. The tremendous amount of understanding of the person who Christ is there. So if you teach one Old Testament passage, if you want to read one at night to them, read this one. Be able to explain it, but you cannot read it to them, 2 Kings 5, without giving them what? 2 Kings 6. You have to have 2 Kings 6, the floating axe head, along with the leprosy of Naaman the Syrian. Needless to say, after doing this the other week, I was quite impressed and pleased to have so many of you. And you do it almost every Sunday, but you did it really well this last one. Without prompting, I had about 7 or 8 of you up here, and you begin to come up and give me your interpretations of the hidden meanings of 2 Kings 5, or the Christology of it, and that is wonderful, the typology, or the Christ inside of 2 Kings 5 and 2 Kings 6. Because you know, or you should know, and I want you to know, within this literally true story, and it's very important to understand that, this is a literally true story. What do I mean by a literally true story? Yes, thank you, it's literally true. Duh, it absolutely is. This is a literally true story, not an allegory, not something that portrays something else that didn't really happen. This actually happened. Elisha lived, said these very things. Naaman lived, the Syrian commander. He had leprosy. He raged and was furious. He returns. He wants 2 mule loads of dirt. All of those details, absolutely, perfectly true. Just like Adam and Eve and every other story in Scripture. Absolutely, perfectly true. All of it happened. The young captive Israelite girl lived. Yes, sir. Yeah, absolutely right. The biggest mistake you can make is to think that the Bible is full of stories. It isn't. Oh, they say it all the time. They say it all the time. But that, I could kind of say it here because I know who my audience is, but if you say that in front of people that don't understand what the Bible really is, you'll mislead them. And so it's very important to understand that Bill is correct. It is a historical account. He wanted 2 mule loads of dirt. Not 3, not 1, not 8, not 10. He wanted 2. And those two are very important. Gehazi is white as snow. He has this leprosy disease of that time, not Hansen's disease, not of today. He actually turned white as snow. All of these people did and said what was recorded, literally true. And what does God do with this actual account, this actual thing, if you will, that occurred? He uses all of it to teach doctrine, to reveal himself to us through the fabric of the event. He places himself. That is the Christology. So within that story, 2 Kings 5, is Christ's redemptive work. There's prophecy of him. There's doctrine. And always search for it. And I say this as much as I can, not enough. If you read the Old Testament and do not find Jesus Christ, you have missed the purpose. And you are miserably lost. Anyway, after the sermon, many of you came up and you foregoed the buffet to offer analysis. And that, by the way, is the best possible result I could hope for in what I do. My analysis, that's why I read, do not take yourself seriously. Because, oh, and by the way, if I read something like that, usually I'm reading it because it applies to me. The worst thing you can say is he's talking to me. Because then that identifies you as guilty. I know that what I say, most of it just disappears and is not remembered. I know. I've tested people before. I know, poof, it's gone. Usually there's about 8-10 minutes of concentration, and then we're nowhere, no telling where you are, and it's okay. I don't take it personally anymore since, well, no. It took me a while to realize that as a teacher, especially in high school. But my point is that it is critical that you say it. That's why I say to you to tell your children, to teach somebody this story, especially your kids. Sit down and say, today, and Bill's right, tell this account. Sit down with them and say, here is what happened in 2 Kings 5 and 6. So when you came up last week to provide your analysis, that is terrific. That is all that I could hope for, because I know it stops being something I tell you or something you read in a book and it becomes part of you. It becomes yours. That's the point. That's what we're trying to do, is for it to become yours. It isn't any good if you hear my faith or you hear my analysis. It must be your analysis. It must be your faith. And you really understand that when you have children and they're 20, because you realize that you can't save them. They have to have their own decisions. But anyway, it's sometimes difficult to break through, and quite a few of you write on the board and leave because of the food. And that, I think. And that happened again last Sunday. And I noticed the person writing it as they were writing it, but I didn't have time. I was talking to others. I didn't know what they were writing. Sometimes I have to erase the insults very quickly so that there aren't any testaments of it. But I did see the process. I didn't really know what the specific. And here's what was written, sort of. It's right here. I wrote, do not erase, save on it. Here's what was written, sort of. I didn't have it at home. I just knew that it was up there. And so I'm kind of putting it in my own words here. Elisha, the person that wrote this, and I won't reveal who they are, because that would embarrass them. But their initials are Jeff. Anyway, they wrote this on the board, and they said this. Elisha is in the position of representing God the Father as holy judge. Naaman is in the position of representing the lost, raging, hating, filth, unclean sinner who's dying and who is hopeless and is seeking life. Gehazi, and this is exactly right, is the Pharisee, is the legalist, is the Judaizer. And that explains why a man who is totally leprous and dying at the end of this account is able to have descendants. Do you see? Christ calls the Pharisees what? A brood of viper serpents. Your father is Satan, he says. And what are they? They are legalists who try to tell you that your salvation is based on what? Your list, as Jeff pointed out. Do I have more good things than bad things? Do you have more good things than bad things? No, are you kidding me? What are you, brain damaged? You have more bad things in the last 30 seconds than you're going to have good things all week. Understand yourself. There is no way your list is ever going to be more good than bad. It's not going to happen. If you think your salvation is going to be accomplished by what you do, you are Gehazi, a descendant of Gehazi. You are a Pharisee. You do one thing in your life, figure out what a Pharisee is, and don't be it. The young Israelite captive girl is who? Who is it? This person has an opinion. I can't read it. It's too small. Who can read that? But have an opinion. Who is the young Israelite slave girl in that account? What does she do? She sends Naaman to what? To Christ. That's what she does. So who is she? She is a witness. Any specific witness? You got your choices of what witness it is. Okay. And all of that is very good deduction and wonderfully done. The only one that I really see that is missing in all of that is the messenger. And he has his dirt position and everything else. I'm just have your own. Think it through. Figure out what you think it represents. Because know that if you miss Christ in it, you have missed it. Find Christ. Anyway, there's no dispute. Question mark. There may very well be dispute. There is no dispute with respect to Elijah that he is in the position of the smoking furnace or the flaming torch of Genesis 15. So now this is how this fits into Genesis 15. Which is he? Those of you who have been here, and I appreciate the visitors very much. We didn't shine a light on you today or ask you for more tithing. We'll let you eat from the buffet. We're not going to sing any songs to you, and you can't possibly know what I'm talking about. Because this is lecture number what? 76. So we've had about 40 in a row here that are just as confusing as this one. But my point being is that those of you who don't have that excuse, and there's a couple that do, and you can go first in the buffet line. Which one is he, the smoking furnace or the flaming torch? Oh, that's a... Okay, raise your hand. Carefully, if you think it is the flaming torch. There's a couple of 3, 4 flaming torches, 5, 6, 7 of you, 8, who in the back, I see your hand. I'm kidding. Some are saying both, some are saying, how many smoking furnaces do I have? Remember, Naaman could not see him. Elisha refused to be seen and sent out a messenger, wouldn't talk to Naaman. Why couldn't he talk to Naaman? Why couldn't he? Because Naaman is filthy, dying, decaying, sinful, lost. And Elisha doesn't see him. And Naaman is furious about that. Why is he furious? Because he doesn't think he's filthy, unclean, dying, decaying, and lost, does he? He thinks he's got a list of pretty good things. Not why. Same thing. Same exact thing.
That's a great out.
I do. But you sit there pretty soon, you'll say, you are right. It is exactly the same thing. Paying for it, being able to pay for it, is exactly the same as saying that you are not filthy, unclean, decaying, and lost. Okay? How many agree with me now? Wow, I win again. No, but really good. Very good. Okay. That's why I put there is no dispute, by the way, with respect to Elisha. I try to find somebody that will dispute that he is in the position of the smoking furnace. Believe it or not, that's what everybody picks. And it is because of the messenger. It is because he is in the holiness position and cannot be in the presence of sin, which means that if he was in the presence of sin, that would require judgment. And so there has to be cleansing first. That is the majority view. Don't fight with me right now. I'm running out of time. Keep your thought. I agree with those of you who are saying, wait a minute, isn't that obvious? But just know that you'll find that the most often. No caffeine in the Coke, but there is aluminum poisoning, so it isn't worthless. Keeping in mind that God is triune, that's what we're going to get into right now here because of this. Is he the smoking furnace? Is he the lamp torch? Is he both? Keeping in mind that God is triune and the whole undivided, let me say that again, the whole undivided essence of God belongs equally to each, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Okay? There are three co-eternal and co-equal persons. Here's Warfield or Ryrie. This is what they say. The same in essence, but distinct in necessary existence. Now, Warfield says this. The same in substance, but distinct in necessary subsistence. Now, that's a lot of difficult terminology to bring to the forefront that it is Jesus Christ who is given all judgment, John 5:22. So when judgment is happening, it is Jesus Christ that is doing it. He has been given all judgment. The Father judges no one, but has committed all judgment to the Son, John 5:22. That aside, no one sees the Father. So who is Elisha? Jesus Christ, God the Son, is the visible of the invisible, Colossians 1:15. So who's the messenger? Is it making sense to anybody but me? Thank you for your answers there. When we have seen Jesus Christ, we have seen the Father, John 14:9. So all of that is in the background with Elisha and the messenger. Naaman, in his lost, sinful, unclean condition, is unable to stand in the presence of God, whether or not he can pay for it, which he cannot pay for it, or not. He's in need of what? He's in need of cleansing, and how is he going to get it? He's got to have it given to him through who? A messenger. Now, we're in a lot of interesting places. We're in Deuteronomy 18:15 because a messenger is called by God a what? What's a messenger? John the Baptist was a messenger. What's he? He's a prophet. Prophets are called messengers. Priests are called messengers, Malachi 2:7. Okay? Angels are called messengers. And then we have Malachi 3:1. Now I'm out of places because I didn't erase last week. Anybody solve the 153 fish? Malachi 3:1. Malachi 3:1 will tell you that the messenger of the covenant is who? Oh, I'll give you a hint. It's all capitalized. The messenger of the covenant is who? Jesus Christ. So all of them are messengers. So who is the messenger here? Only after being saved from sin, resurrected and changed and cleansed, then now Naaman returns to God. That, of course, makes it obvious why 2 Kings 6 must be tied to 2 Kings 5, right? Everyone agrees with that. Good. Moving on. No one knows what I'm talking about. Do not feel intimidated. But I'm just setting that up for you. I get ahead of myself. Returning to God is the lesson of 2 Kings 6. So now you understand that when Naaman is cleansed and returns to Elisha, wants his 2 mule loads of dirt, will offers his payment, and it is refused, All of that has to do with 2 Kings 6. That which is borrowed and lost must be returned is the theme of 2 Kings 5 and the theme of 2 Kings 6. 2 Kings 5 and 2 Kings 6 form a complete whole, if you will. They're three pieces. Think of them as part A, part B, and part C, if you want. Never separate Naaman from Gehazi from the axe head of iron. Try to keep all of those together when you tell your kids the story. This is a play with three acts, if that makes sense to you. And I'm always fascinated that churches don't do dramatic representations of 2 Kings 5 and 6. It has everything. If you think about it, it has the ugly, disfigured, ranting, angry, furious military commander, which would be John May. For a while, you thought ugly, disfigured, ranting, angry, furious might be me. I know you did, but no, no. Military, that makes it John. It has a teenage girl who knows everything. Pretty much sums it up there. It has a politician slash king who is useless. It has employees who have to calm down the boss. It has two mules and dirt, so you got the animals. Everybody loves animals. Right? It has an evil plotting schemer. It has death in it. It also has resurrection in it. Then it has that wonderful ironic twist that God, only God can do. Only God can conceive. You know, Gehazi, he runs after Naaman and he says the opposite of Elisha. Gehazi says the opposite of salvation by grace. He says salvation by works. So understand that. But he says this, I will take something from Naaman. And he succeeds in taking something from Naaman. What does he get? He gets death. He takes the judgment and the leprosy and the sin and the death. So that irony is great. And so this is the classic, because you never, at Christmas, as you learn from the Christmas sermon, the theme of the Christmas sermon is leprosy. That's absolutely right. Well said. Theme of Christmas is leprosy. Might not have said that, but notice how I make it happen, because I'm a trained professional. So why not do this at Christmas? Put the big sign out there. Cliffside presents angry, dying leprosy man. Be great. Did you notice? I wasn't going to say this, but I drove by the live nativity thing. You know, where people stand out and freeze and do something that is totally biblically illiterate. And God smote it with a 100-mile-an-hour wind. He blew the hay bale right out in the middle of the road and dropped it. I don't think it can be rebuilt. I really wish he had firebombed it, but I think he finally got tired of it. Yay. I don't have to drive by it. I couldn't help but chuckle when I saw it in shreds. But anyway, Cliffside presents angry, dying leprosy man. Think of the crowds. Okay? Who could we get to play Naaman, right? That's what you do. It would be easy to find a teenage girl who is always giving advice. That's not going to be a problem. And a greedy, scheming church leader, that is a piece of cake, baby. There'll be a line out the door finding that guy, right? Okay, back to the sermon. The point that I'm trying to make is that typological interpretation is very, very rarely obvious and is greatly and hotly debated, as it should be. There's many subtle details to consider. And what do I want you to do when you're studying Naaman? I want you to argue amongst yourselves. I want you to say, no, the messenger is John the Baptist, or it's the priesthood, or it's the church, or it's the apostles, or it's the church, or Israel. It's the two witnesses of Revelation. I don't care who you say it is, but I want you to think of something, have a position, and go into the fray with it. And if you get your head chopped off, what do we call that? Wonderful. Because that's how it works. If you got a lousy position, you get your face beat in, wonderful. You'll know better. You'll know that position didn't hold any water. And some of you do this all the time. You do it online, and it's just a wonderful thing you're doing. It makes it yours. That's what I'm trying to get you to do here as well. Also, however, to the frustration of many, most portraits of Christ are in shadow. They are incomplete. And which, by the way, is how it should be. I know, but it's how it should be. The Old Testament testifies. It is a prophecy of the comings of Christ, of his titles, of his positions as Savior, as Judge, as King, as Priest, as God in the flesh. No human or collection of humans could possibly depict the person of Christ. The best we can do, the best the Old Testament can do, is be a shadow, a dim portrait, a dark kind of fuzzy picture. Because he's who? He's God. A finite human being cannot depict an infinite God. Cannot. The infinite God. So expect that the types will be incomplete. If they were complete, what do we have? We have an error. God, lucky God, wrote his book. He just pulled another rabbit out of the hat. That omniscience is such a handy thing. Rejoice that they're shadows. They're supposed to be shadows. Also, but it frustrates people. They want the Bible to be a 20-minute sitcom. Okay, 19 minutes, show's about to over. Show's about to over. Don't pick on me. I'm tired. No caffeine. Also, a source of frustration for many is the shifting of typology, or what I call the Samson effect, because Samson typifies it best. Samson is an adulterous, blind person who is captive in the world, but is remembered by God. Who's that? Adulterous and blind, but remembered by God. That is the nation of Israel. Samson takes honey from the carcass of a lion and feeds it to others, and there he becomes a portrait of the Antichrist. If you study, it's very complicated, but that's the solution to honey from the carcass of a lion. Samson is the son of a barren woman. He is one of the seven miraculous births. So first, he's a type of Israel. Second, he's a type of Antichrist. And then he is one of the seven miraculous births. He is a Nazarite, or Nazareth, if you will. He's dedicated to God from the womb to the day of his death. Jesus Christ himself comes to Samson's mother and says very similar things that were said to Mary. And Samson is an obvious type of Christ, and that's what makes him so confusing, is the shifting that he does, literally, almost verse to verse. As an aside, I have the Wally Cox, Woody Allen position on Samson. In other words, Samson was not a huge, powerful man. If you saw Samson, you would see Woody Allen. Samson was small and thin, frail looking. You ever see that in the movies or the comic books? Check the evidence. Check me out. See, that would explain why the Palestinians, the Philistines, same word, that would explain why the Philistines were shocked at his incredible physical strength, why they sought to learn the secret. He didn't look powerful. He was an average-looking, smallish Jewish man. Samson was weak-looking. He was a weak-looking Jew who could perform miraculous feats of strength, vastly outnumbered. He could kill thousands. Note the prophecy. A small, tiny, could defeat a great, large multitude. A tiny man able to defeat powerful armies. Who is he there? He's Israel, isn't he? And do it because of a miraculous effort by God himself. So my favorite Samson line in my Samson play is, "Help, run for your lives, it's Woody Allen come to kill you." Okay? If you make him this powerful, huge man, you recognize that you defeat the Israelite or the Israel prophecy, don't you? Okay, quickly, almost done. Got a late start today. I sat in the office napping. This is the latest today, by the way, that I have ever come to a church service was today. Isn't that true? The latest we've ever come. We just did not get moving today. Here we go, 2 Kings 6, because you can't do 2 Kings 5 unless you do 2 Kings 6. So open up your textbook, 2 Kings 6. Got to tell this to your kids. I don't care how old you are, you still have kids. They want to know. I'll wait for you to turn. You're still wrestling. I know I go much faster than you, Bean. That's right. I train professionally. Here we go, 2 Kings 6, 1 through 6. And while we're reading this together, while you're reading it, what are you looking for? If you don't find it, what has happened to you? You are looking for Jesus Christ. If you don't find him, or his redemptive work, or his person, or his character, or something about him, if you don't find it, then you have missed the purpose of it. And then at the same time, in your brain, you're going, but you already know, because of the word return, borrowed, that it ties into 2 Kings 5. How does that work? They are three pieces. This is the third act of the play. We just did Gehazi turning to snow, and we got to go back again and figure out Miriam next week, but now we have the third act. And the sons of the prophet said to Elisha, what's the obvious question? What are they talking about? Is this a good thing or a bad thing? Start out again. And the sons of the prophet said to Elisha, see now. Okay? Is this going to be a good thing or a bad thing? How many vote good? This will be good. Imagine your kid coming up to you going, see now. Will that be a good thing or a bad thing? It could be good. Figure it out. See now, the place where we dwell for with you is too small for us. Is it going to be a good thing or a bad thing? Please, let us go to the Jordan. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Why did they want to go to the Jordan? Why not Florida? Let us go to the Jordan and let every man take a beam from there and let us make there a place where we may dwell. With you? No, that's missing. So he answered, go. Is that good or bad? My kids came up to me and said, you know, Dad, the place where we're dwelling here with you is too small for us. That is a good thing. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Yeah. Then one said, please consent to go with your servants. That's a good thing, they said that. That helps them a lot. And he answered, I will go. Now, when I say, I will go, you think who? Say it louder. Yeah, absolutely. Jesus Christ says, I will go. And he goes. You see, the same thing in Joseph, when he is sent by the Father. The beloved son sent by the father to the brothers who were lost and away from the father says, sends him for them, and he goes willingly and obediently. So he went with them, and when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was cutting, now, where is the Jordan now? Is that a good place or a bad place? Make your conclusion. Tell me. It means death and judgment, doesn't it? It's a bad place. Why do they want to go to a bad place? And when they came to, and who are they? When they came to Jordan, they cut down trees, but as one was cutting down a tree, the iron axe head fell into the water, and he cried out and said, alas, master, for it was borrowed. Great despair. He has an iron axe head. He's cutting down a tree. By the way, we lost a tree again. Who cuts down Christmas trees January the 15th. They hacked it off. It's probably the same guy from last year.
I'm trying to figure out who would do it, but he did it. $300 trees. That's two of them we've lost. Back to this story. See how easily distracted I am? But as one was cutting down a tree, the iron axe head fell into the water, and he cried out and said, "Alas, master, for it was borrowed." Great despair. "I am doomed," he said, "'cause it's borrowed." So the man of God said, "Where did it fall?" Now, who is the man of God representing here? Yeah, Jesus Christ. Does Jesus Christ know where it fell? So why is he asking? It isn't for Christ's sake. He's omniscient. It's for our sake. And he showed him the place. Now, isn't that cool? Because, see now, the place where we dwell is too small for us. Where did it fall? And he showed him the place. So he cut off a stick and threw it out, threw it in there, and he made the iron float. Therefore, he said, "Pick it up for yourself." So he reached out his hand and took it. Now, the obvious questions. We've got to hurry. We've got to hustle. We're not going to answer a single question. What place is place? What place is place? The place where we dwell is too small for us. Let us make there a place where we may dwell. Show me the place, essentially. What place is place? You've got to figure out where the places are and why they're places. Does that make sense? Good. Who is Elijah portraying and how so exactly? Who are the prophets that don't like where they're at? They want to go someplace else. What is the significance of Elisha saying, "I will go"? We covered that. Leaving one place, going to another place, which is the Jordan River. That, by the way, is exactly what Christ did. What is the borrowed iron axe? What is it? And you lose it in the Jordan River, which descends from Adam into death and judgment. When you lose it into the Jordan River and it's gone and you're in despair because you borrowed it, who'd you borrow it from? You got a choice. You have the smoking furnace or the flaming torch of Genesis 15. Again, what place is the place? Where did it fall? Why the crying and the sorrow and the despair over the axe that fell into the place? Out of this place, this Jordan River, comes that which must be returned. Out of death and judgment comes something that has to be returned to the rightful owner. Who is the rightful owner of the axe head? And he wants it back. And you borrowed it. And he wants it back in good condition. Now you threw it in a river of death and judgment. He's going to float it back up, isn't he? It's his. What of you, let me ask it this way. What of you do you own? I love it when Christians say, "Come see my stuff." There's no more ignorant statement than that. You can't be more ignorant. Look what I got. That's mine. The beating stops when the morale improves. Okay. The impossible happens by throwing in a stick. What is the stick? Better question. Who is the stick? Better question. The impossible happens by throwing in a branch that is cut down. Who is the branch? When was he cut down? By throwing in the branch, that which is lost and borrowed is returned, and the despair is ended. You can note the similarity between Exodus 15, 22 through 25. Moses throws in a branch to do what? The water is poison. The branch must go in to remove the poison. Okay? Explain the most difficult portion of this entire part to your kids tonight and your friends.
Pick it up yourself. Whoa, baby. Pick it up for yourself. So he reached out his hand and took it. Great debate over those two. And when you're done with that, connect all of that to Naaman the Syrian. That's your assignment. See you next week. Have your papers ready. We'll collect them at the beginning of class. I'm kidding. Let's rise. Be dismissed.